and she returned his gesture with a slight bow of her own. She looked at her watch. "So," I said before, 15 minutes. Now it is 5 minutes. "I wish I could join you," the priest said. He placed Waiting for God together with his breviary and slipped the pair of books under his arm. "Some other time, perhaps?" "Yes," she said, and put her hand out. They shook. "Bonne chance, mon père." She turned and walked away. Kavanaugh knew that, given his response to her, the expected thing would be for him to zip up his coat and leave. He'd made it seem that the press of his schedule precluded his joining the tour. But in fact, his next obligation wasn't until mid-afternoon, religion class for the 6th and 7th graders. He had turned down her invitation reflexively. It wasn't a docent's spiel he wanted. What then? Instead of resuming his place on the stone bench of the chapter house, he turned and entered the ambulatory, falling into the slow pace proper to a monk reciting the office. Would he resume the business of seeming to pray? He could not have explained his impulse to remain in the museum. Had the enchantments of the place trumped his parochial resentments? No, something else. He took up his breviary again. Priests like him called the black psalter with gold leaf pages the wife, that they called their chosen spiritual reading, his other book, the mistress, did not seem funny now. Indeed, the Simon Veil volume rode with fresh awkwardness beneath his arm. Kavanaugh flipped the breviary ribbon and read, "Exaudi Deus orationem meam cum deprecor, a timore inimici erepe anima meam." He muscled his way through the Latin. "Deliver my soul from the fear of the enemy." Cradling the breviary, pressing the Veil against his side, he had made 2 complete circuits of the colonnade when he saw the woman again, this time without a group. She was unaware of him as she entered the cloister, and when she stepped into the arcade, as it happened, she cut him off. He stopped. "My goodness," she said, startled, "I am sorry." Now she too was holding a book, a thin, leather-bound volume. "My fault," Kavanaugh said. "Please, pardon me." He adjusted a ribbon and closed his breviary. "I thought you had gone," she said. "Wasn't ready to face my afternoon," he smiled. "6th graders." Because Kavanaugh had been walking and because the arcaded promenade invited it, he started to resume his pace, then stopped. With a gesture, he invited her to walk beside him. She hesitated. He apologized. "I've cluttered your space, haven't I? You came in here to, what do we say, perambulate?" "It's true. When no one arrives for the guided lecture, I come in here alone." "Preserve your solitude," Simone Weil says. The woman only looked at him. "I feel bad then," Kavanaugh said. "I should have joined you for the tour." "Why are you still here?" she asked. Her direct question threw him. Also, it made him want to answer. He looked up. The rain was drumming the glass canopy. "I was hoping it would stop," he said. But the rain was not what had kept him here, and it suddenly seemed deceptive to imply that it had. He said, "Something bothered me this morning. I came to the cloisters by accident, but it feels like the place to be." "I understand." She looked around. "I imagine the men and women who built this place 1,000 years ago. It consoles me." "Consoles you," Kavanaugh said slowly, surprising himself. "From what?" Instead of answering, she stared at him coldly. Or rather, as he realized then, her stare was her answer. He said, "I'm sorry." She said calmly, "It would be rude of me to ask what bothered you this morning. How could you imagine I would explain myself to you?" He glanced around. 1,000 years, you said. The place surprised me, that's all. You surprised me." What had she said about they? Her empathy was suffering, which was limited but quite real. This woman and Simone Weil, he thought again, were alike. He said, "You seem to say what comes to mind. For a change, that's what I did just now. Not like me, but I take your point. And yes, it was rude. None of my business. The cloister is no excuse. After all, it is not real." "But it is. This very place, abbots and abbesses, monks and nuns, we know their names. They were trying for something that cannot be seen, something that lasts. Such men and women should not be forgotten." With that, she made a slight gesture with her book. "Cluny, you said. La Chapelle sur Loire. But now a museum." She shrugged. "Cluny itself is a museum now." Kavanaugh felt entirely displaced, as if he and this woman were meeting in a realm apart, speaking a language that whatever it was to her was new to him. "The place no longer serves its purpose," he said. "But its purpose was always to remember, no? A museum, a sanctuary, all the same." "But in the museum, the past is dead," Kavanaugh said carefully. Such a portentous statement was unlike him, yet he pushed it further, saying, "Remembering can be a death grip. The sanctuary is for life." A dark expression came over her face, unpleasant, almost mean, but she banished the dour look and held up her thin volume again. "You have your books, Father. I have mine. History. Le Moyen Âge." The priest thought finally of Runner again. He wanted all at once to tell someone what had happened at Mass that morning, that strange, unsettling apparition. And now this woman, too, another sort of visitant. He had met her because of Runner. She was a match for Runner, strange, unsettling. He said, "You say it would be rude of you to ask what bothered me, but what if, despite myself, that's why I mentioned it, hoping you would ask?" Rachel Vedette, again, answered with her stare. Finally, gesturing at his bravery with no hint of her public face, she said, "You should complete your obligation, Father." With that, she turned and walked out of the cloister. Chapter 2. Rachel Vedette carried it with her everywhere, a gnarled scar on memory. The sweltering day when all had changed, July 16th, 1942. Life can be transformed in a snap, a cosmic shift determined by 1 hour that glows red through the chilly gray of mundane experience ever after. Since then, she had sought not to undo what had happened, impossible, but only to find again and claim any one of the many aspirations that had belonged to her before. She was 20. As she hurriedly set out for home from the Musée de Cluny that afternoon, even the wide sidewalks of Boulevard Saint-Germain were deserted, which had not been the case the other times. The vacant street amplified her alarm. She was already running and now ran faster. The skirt of her loose-fitting summer dress flared at her knees. Unruly wisps of her dark hair, having come loose from the plaited coil of her tightly pulled back bun, flew at her face. Rumors had yet again swept Paris. But this afternoon, in the archive of the Institut Médiéval, housed in the Musée, a clerk who had often looked her over but never spoken to her approached her work table under the cone-shaped hanging lamps of the high-vaulted reading room to lean close and whisper, "The Germans are arresting the Jews." The shock of what the man said was compounded by her instant question, "How does he know I'm Jewish?" But then he said, "The wandering days of Les Lupins are over," and she realized he was including her not in the insulted group, but in the group having the right to slur. He did not know. She turned away and began to gather her papers, but he touched her arm. You should not go out. Let the crowds do their business.
Their business? She asked.
He shrugged. It's only Jews.
Only Jews? She replied sharply.
And then, at the mercy of a bolt of anger, she added recklessly, My father is a Jew. He drew back quizzically. And so am I, she added, although it was only her father of whom she was thinking.
But you...
He glanced at the pages on the table, her own handwriting, and the manuscript facsimiles that she was copying, musty texts that he himself had delivered to her. The clerk had seen her at this table for months, an unusual doctorant, so young and pretty. He'd used the rumor about the Jews as a pretext to approach her.
But what? I work on Peter Abelard, she said.
That unforgotten man of Le Haut Moyen Age had spoken from and to the soul of La France for most of 1,000 years. But what meaning could the infamous Catholic monk have for Jews?
Is that your question? She asked.
Rachel read the confusion so clearly in the man's eyes that she sternly made his question even more explicit.
What is Peter Abelard to a Jew?
Nothing, he answered, but he was backing away now.
That's what you think, she'd said.
She'd left the manuscript stack for him to refile, pushed the last of her own pages into her briefcase, and rushed out of the archive. Now at Rue Dante, she dashed across the oddly vacant boulevard into the narrower street that would take her to the river at the Pont au Double, and to the islands beyond, including hers. Now she ran along the very center of the street itself. That the city was deserted frightened her. Over the previous year, the other rumors of Jews being arrested had never proved accurate, and she hoped that this one, too, was false. At each of those other reports, a new clique had disappeared from the Marais, the Jewish quarter on the right bank, a mile or more from the apartment she shared with her father. But those Jews had not been arrested. They had fled Paris, and each time Saul Vedette had pleaded with his daughter to go too. But her father, severely diabetic, was tethered to the local chemist who supplied his insulin, and she'd have had to go without him. Unthinkable. Since his wife had died 5 years before, Vedette had become wholly dependent on Rachel, even as the disease had progressively weakened him. Rachel was like her mother in thinking of herself as French first, which meant being more detached from Jewishness than her father, who was a professor, after all, of medieval Jewish history specializing in Talmud. In the beginning, she'd found it impossible to believe that the jeopardy of the Jews of France could be real, but the sequential promulgations of the Statut des Juifs since 1940 had made her, too, understand that a noose was tightening on the Israelite throat, especially once her father was dismissed from the university. Still, they encouraged each other in the belief that they'd be safe because they did not live in the Marais, among kosher butchers, Judaica shops, and synagogues. Indeed, few Jews lived on their island in the Seine, and since her father's banishment, when even the Institute was close to him, he had rarely shown himself in public. The Germans were said to be scouring municipal census records for Jewish names, but Vedette, a military term meaning foremost sentry, had been adopted by a forebear serving in Napoleon's Grande Armée, an assimilationist betrayal of God's people for which at last Saul Vedette could be grateful. Rachel, for her part, had easily continued to blend in as just another Sorbonne étudiante, even as she surreptitiously took up her father's research in the archive. As far as most of his former colleagues knew, Saul Vedette was simply one of those Jews who'd already taken the hint and fled Paris. So once more, the terrible thing she'd done hit Rachel, as of only the month before, there were some who knew very well who and where he was, and they knew because of her. As she drew closer to the river, with her satchel banging at her side, Rachel pictured him, dozing in his chair by the window. Beside him would be a last ribbon of smoke rising from the ashtray on the table.
Next to the ashtray would be the worn leather volume, Historia Calamitatum, Eloise et Abelardi Epistolae, a text that he had come to know so well he needed not to read but only to fondle it. On that table also would be assembled numerous pages of manuscript in her own hand, alongside other pages that she had herself put through the typewriter, his dictation. Behind his chair, on the small bookcase, would be other stacks of such pages, in both handwriting and typescript, Latin and French. Flanking the bookcase would be the bent wood chairs that had last been used when the review committee had come to the apartment for that awful hearing, again because of her. Now, running along the boulevard, she conjured images of home as a way to fend off panic, the picture of her father dozing. Her mind flew ahead. As always, she would rouse him softly with a kiss on the forehead, then stand aside while he made his way to the water closet. She would go to the sink in the small kitchen to wash her hands. When he returned, he would have left his shirt out of his trousers ready for the injection. By then, she would already have prepared the cotton swabs with rubbing alcohol and retrieved the insulin syringe and the rubber vial cap, both of which she'd have sterilized after the morning shot by boiling them in a small cast-iron pressure cooker on the stove. When he sat again, she would take from the shelf above his chair the mahogany jewelry box in which once Rachel's mother had kept pearls and rings and the small silver mezuzah she had from her rabbi grandfather, the mezuzah she could neither hang at the door nor part with. But the box now held Saul's insulin vials. Rachel would open it, remove the active vial, and cap it with the rubber stopper. Raising the syringe to eye level against the window light, she would expel its air. She would push the needle through the vial cap and, once more against the light, carefully draw exactly 8 units of serum into the barrel. 8 units in the late afternoon, 6 units in the early morning. Then, with her father pinching a fold of flesh at his abdomen, she would stab the needle in, expertly push the plunger, pull it out, and swab the pasty flab all in one continuous movement. "Voilà, papa," she would always say, putting the needle aside. Only then, having winced not at all, would he greet her, reaching up to grasp her shoulders, pulling her cheek down to his, first one, then the other, and saying, as he always did, "Merci, merci. I would be lost without you, my dearest, dearest girl." Then he would turn away to hide his eyes, so full of water not from pain but from feeling. She tore across the Pont au Doble, onto the Ile de la Cité, ever more troubled at how godforsaken Paris felt. There seemed to be no river traffic, no taxis at the stand. Approaching the cathedral, she was relieved to see a clutch of people in the plaza. But they were heading into the great church, a dozen old women she saw now, widows of the Great War, famously appointed to pray the daily rosary for the dead heroes of France. Rachel had heard it said that Catholics, when they recited the Ave these days, substituted the name of Marshal Pétain for Mary. Notre Dame, of course, was the storied demesne of Abelard and his famous lover, Eloise. But that day, it was a mark on her passage home, that's all. The towering cathedral was roughly the midway point between the museum and the book-lined apartment she shared with her father on Ile Saint-Louis, the village-like cluster of faded mansions and subdivided townhouses on the cathedral's sister island. On most days, coming home from the museum, she would see off-duty German soldiers sunbathing on the grass behind the apse. But now they were not there. She imagined the soldiers mustered, fully uniformed, at loose in the streets, rifles at the ready, in their brown trucks, mounted on motorcycles, blowing whistles, slamming through doors, boots loud upon stair treads. And indeed, just then she heard the faint wailing of far-off sirens, the urgent up and down of a screeching beast. The high-pitched squeal was coming, yes, from the right bank, around Rue Saint-Paul, the Marais, with its closed-in streets, lanes, and squares, to which, for more than a year, her father had forbidden her to go. Of course, what were sirens in occupied Paris? French police rushing from one bureau to another, ambulances carrying the valorous near-dead from the front, Wehrmacht brass in train with their escorts. Sirens were nothing, she wanted to tell herself. But these sirens, she was certain, were coming from the Jewish quarter. Thank God we don't live there. She might have dropped her satchel to run faster, to hell with the thing. But at the archive she had gathered up 2 weeks' worth of copying and frantically stuffed the pages into the bag. Pages she believed, despite the dismissive verdict of the Sorbonne reviewers, that were still keeping her father alive. However desolate he'd become, she had helped him continue with his project. Each page she carried home was a token of his hope, each one a talisman, magic. Normally, when crossing the last bridge into her own home enclave, she relaxed, comforted by the special island air of exemption from the stresses of Paris that had defined Île-Saint-Louis for 200 years. But now she became even more frantic. These streets, too, were empty, and that seemed, if anything, still more ominous than the far-off sirens. At the corner café, Deux Garçons, where Rue Jean du Ballet met Rue Saint-Louis, she had an impulse to rush in and ask Monsieur Béguin if it was true. The Germans were coming? She glimpsed him, standing in the window at his black vest and bow tie, perhaps raising his hand to wave, but she simply ran past. 2 blocks along Rue Saint-Louis, she came finally to their apartment house. She turned her key quickly and bolted through the small entrance foyer, but not so swiftly that she failed to notice Madame Boudreau's firmly shut door. Usually the door was kept slightly ajar at all hours, enabling the concierge to track the comings and goings of the 2 dozen people who lived in the once grand old building. Rachel ignored the closet-sized elevator, its electricity had been shut off the year before, and took to the winding staircase. By the time she reached the 4th floor, she could hardly breathe. But then she saw that the door to their apartment was standing wide open. She forgot her exhaustion and stopped. She stood at the threshold looking in. The main room, with its glass-fronted armoire and stuffed sofa, was orderly, as was, beyond the separating arch, the far alcove that served as her father's study. His chair was there, by the window. But with her father gone from it, the piece of furniture seemed defective. The pair of bentwood chairs were in place, at the bookshelf. The only sign of disarray was a fan of papers on the floor. But then she saw that the sheets half-covered her father's black yarmulke, which, when he was awake indoors, was always on his head. On the floor beside the yarmulke were his spectacles. Rachel dropped the satchel and moved slowly into the apartment. Papa? Papa? He was not there. This recognition, oddly, cauterized her panic. And all at once a calm detachment came over her. She stooped to retrieve his yarmulke, held it briefly to her breast, then put it in the side pocket of her dress. His meerschaum pipe was in its ashtray. She picked it up. Cold. She crossed to his bedroom, then to her own small, curtained-off corner. She opened the door to the water closet. She craned into the tiny kitchen. Back in his study, she stooped to retrieve her pages from the floor and carefully align them on the table, beside the worn leather volume that always sat there. She flicked a pinch of spilled ashes away. Slowly turning, she surveyed the bookshelves, the typewriter, the reams of manuscript. The jumble was normal untidiness. On impulse, she went back to her father's bedroom and opened his closet door, to see his heavy winter shoes properly in place on the floor. If she'd been a detective, she'd have been making notes on her pad. But then, in her father's study again, her eye went to the shelf above his chair, and snap, like that, the rush of feeling returned, a damned torrent breaking loose in her breast again. The mahogany chest was gone. Papa's insulin. Solvedet's diabetes meant that his pancreas failed to produce a sufficient quantity of the hormone that allowed his body to process sugar properly. Without his shots, his body would not absorb sugar and would effectively starve itself. His blood sugar levels would quickly become impossibly high, causing severe dehydration, and within days coma would follow and radical organ failure, beginning with the kidneys. Whoever had taken her father had taken the chest, too. She imagined her father having the presence of mind to insist upon it. But that would have meant taking also the syringe and rubber vial cap, which, after sterilizing, she routinely kept in a freshly laundered linen sleeve on its own shelf in the kitchen. She went there now and, to her dismay, found the needle still in its cloth holder. Solvedet, without his shots, was dead. Rachel left the syringe where it was and rushed from the apartment and rapidly down the stairs. She was quickly at the door to Madame Boudreau's room and banging on it. The woman's voice, plaintive and obviously afraid, came back at her. "Please, please." The door opened. The bent old woman looked up at Rachel as if expecting to be hit. Over her black house dress, she wore a dark blue smock. She was clearly startled to see Rachel and opened her mouth to speak. But no words came. The blow of her foul body odor hit Rachel. "What happened? Who came?" Rachel asked. An inane question, of course. "They did," the old woman answered. "They did. They took the professor."
"Who? Who? Germans?"
"No, not Krauts. Gendarme. French police." The woman tried to close the door, but Rachel stopped her.
"French police?"
"Yes, French."
"Took him where? Where?"
"Who knows? Gone. He is gone. If you were here, they'd have taken you, too. You would not fool them as you do everyone else." Suddenly the woman uncurled herself, almost straightening her back to lunge up at Rachel contemptuously. "You have brought trouble on this house, you and your father." She pushed on the door again. This time Rachel shocked the old lady and herself by forcefully slamming the door all the way open. The woman fell roughly to the floor, and Rachel crossed into her room, a tiny space, holding only a narrow cot, a cluttered deal table, and a doily-backed chair. A small wall shelf had been converted by means of an unevenly pleated faux satin scarf into a pathetic Marian shrine. Behind a thin vase with its bud and a curled rosary stood the Virgin. Made of cheap molded plaster, shoddily painted blue and white, the figure was poised with her face demurely down, as if averting her eyes from what this ferocious, invading Jewess was about to do. Only then did Rachel see what was on the table, amid the clutter of newspapers and dishes. The mahogany chest. Her father's mahogany chest. Her mother's. Its lid was up, showing its store of glass vials, insulin. At once, Rachel understood. After the police took her father away, the concierge stole into their apartment, saw the jewelry box, mistook it for what it once had been, and made off with it. Rachel wheeled on Madame. "You dare to take this, you thief, you fiend?" The woman's eyes cast about, as if help would come. She shielded her face.
"I saved it for you," she whimpered.
The lie so infuriated Rachel that she slapped the woman. It was the first blow she'd ever struck against another human being, and at once Rachel fell back, her hands at her mouth, mirroring Madame Boudreau. Rachel lurched toward the table, closed the lid of the mahogany box, clutched it inside her left arm, and turned back toward the door. But the old woman was in the way. Furious, she sent a wad of spittle into Rachel's face.
"Jew!" the woman screeched. "Stinking Jew!"
Once again, Rachel's reaction was visceral, instant, and unwilled. Instead of hitting the woman, she swung her right arm toward the wall shelf and swept the statue of the Virgin away. It crashed to the floor, smashed into pieces. Quickly she was out, rushing up the stairs. The words, "stinking Jew," were alive in her ear, but her mind roared with the question, "Who am I now?" By the time she was back in the apartment, the vice of her will had closed down on the terrors. With the back of her hand, she had wiped her face clean of saliva. She moved swiftly and steadily, as if through a routine instead of through a sequence of actions she had never imagined. Yet she knew exactly what to do. First, she gathered the foolscap typescript from the bookshelf and a stack of her own handwritten pages. She stuffed them into the satchel she had carried from the Institute, then went into her father's bedroom. At his closet, she knelt and pushed his brogans aside, along with a hodgepodge of old journals and items of soiled laundry. She pulled out a small battered suitcase. This left exposed the wide pine boards of the narrow floor space. Craning in, she pushed down on the rearmost floorboard at a knot by the wall, a particular pressure point that brought the other end of the board up just enough for her to grasp it and pull it free, opening a below-deck space between the joists. She pushed the satchel into the well, an ad hoc vault, then closed the plank again, snapping it back into its close fit. She took the suitcase to the small table by the kitchen, and in short order, carefully filled it with the insulin vials, the syringe kits, the linen sleeves, and the pressure cooker. She took a brick of chocolate from the counter, wrapped it in paper alongside a small folding knife, and put it in the case, together with three precious bananas, a sack of nuts, and a pair of apples. From the highest shelf, she took the hoarded coupons, carte de rationnement, essential to acquiring meat, bread, and eggs, as well as a stash of several thousand paper francs. From the edge of the sink, she took the toothbrushes and tooth powder. Then, from their separate drawers across the room, she took underwear for both of them, his fresh shirt, her sweater. At the suitcase again, she cushioned the medical gear with this clothing and with a small pillow from the sofa. Before closing the suitcase, she looked around carefully. Her eye fell on the small stack of books on her father's table, the Bible, a commentary by Nachmanides, and on top the worn leather volume of Peter Abelard's Historia Calamitatum. She retrieved all three and placed them on the pillow, as if enthroning texts on the bima. The Abelard struck her, yes, a story of calamity, precisely. She took her father's yarmulke out of her pocket and placed it on the book, then closed the suitcase. Pressing down, she forced away the question, how had this happened? Saul Vedette had been a senior directeur de recherche at the Institut Médiéval, a key figure in the modern recovery of medieval manuscripts that had been cast aside in the anti-Catholic frenzy that shook all of France after the Revolution. In addition to the great biblical and theological texts of Christendom, the major monasteries had preserved Jewish and Islamic works too, and the work of the Institute was to reclaim them. Beginning as a young Hebraist, Vedette had done his life's work there, at first a decidedly Jewish project of cataloging fragments of the foundational Talmudic and Kabbalistic documents that had been spirited away by monks. But Saul Vedette had become one of the most revered professors at the Institute, revered, so Rachel had thought, by everyone. Her mistake. One last glance around. What else? His glasses, there, on the floor. She crossed, picked the spectacles up, and put them in the pocket of her dress. Still looking, she asked herself again, what else? She was certain there was something, but could not think what. Then she knew. She returned to her father's closet, reached in between the hanging items of apparel and from the breast of his overcoat,
ripped off the yellow star stamped Juif that she had sewn there herself the year before. He had never once gone outside wearing it. In the kitchen, she found a pin, and with it attached the badge to her dress at her breast. That was all. As she went past Madame Boudreau's door, she again noted that it was firmly shut. Also firmly shut was Rachel's heart against the woman. Only moments later, Rachel presented herself at the Deux Garçons, the corner café. Three out of the seven tables were occupied. At one of those, before a pair of dark-suited men, Monsieur Béguin was placing first one demi-tasse, then the other. When the café proprietor saw Rachel standing in the doorway, he stood motionless, staring. The yellow star on her breast had registered. At first he seemed only perplexed, but then his face softened. Still he did not move. Rachel entered the café, crossed to the zinc-topped coffee bar, put the suitcase down, and stood ready to place an order. Monsieur Béguin came to her, but on his side of the counter. "Whom else did they take?" she asked abruptly. She was thinking, for starters, of the Levies, a family living two doors down from the café, and of the Brissards, an elderly couple whose flat was above the patisserie in the nearby square. "They came only for your father, it seems," the man replied. "No one else on our street was arrested. They went right to your place, direct. They took him, and they left, in and out." Monsieur Béguin looked down, ashamed. "There was nothing to be done." "How did they know?" she asked. He shrugged. "The denaturalization rules?" She said, "My father never registered." "Still," he said, "they knew." He held her eyes with his. "As I say, they went direct, only for your father. They took him." "French police," she said, "not Germans." "I know," he said. And his face reddened with further shame. Rachel withdrew a cigarette pack from her pocket. By the time she'd placed a cigarette between her lips, the proprietor was ready with the match. She took the flame, exhaled. "You might as well serve me coffee while I wait," Rachel said. "Wait for what?" Béguin asked. "The police. I want you to call them. Tell them you've captured a Jew of your own." He shook his head. "No, never." When he lowered his eyes, they snagged on her yellow star. Rachel knew it was unfair to unload this spite on her cowardly neighbor, but she did not care. She said, with a calm that sounded eerie even to her, "Call the police, monsieur. Then, if you please, serve me a coffee." She went to the small table by the window to wait. Soon enough, Monsieur Béguin placed a demi-tasse in front of her. By then, though, she was lost in the pool of her own eyes reflected in the window. But instead of her own face, what she saw was her father's. It was the year before, when Saul Vedette found himself barred from even entering the archive room at the Musée de Cluny, that Rachel, weighing in, had made her first great mistake. She understood that he'd come to live for his new project, and she saw how this final banishment shook him. She insisted that he continue. It was unthinkable to her that his friends on the faculty would not welcome the work once it was completed, and she said as much. She volunteered to exploit her own minor étudiant status at the Sorbonne to become her father's discreet research assistant. Enrolled in the standard history course, she would be freed to roam the archive. "Only point me to the text you need," she said, "and I will reproduce them for you." Vedette was in his chair, pipe in hand. She was standing before him. He smiled sadly. "And bring the occupiers down on you," he said. She shrugged. "I am a Jew, but like Mama was." Vedette smiled. "Modern," he said. "If I am Jewish," she said. My teachers and fellow students care nothing for it. No one at the Institute knows me. As for the Germans, what are the dusty folders of Cluny to them? He said, the dusty folders hold texts cluttered with insular Latin script, difficult to read, which I can readily master. Why else, she said, grinning, did you send me to the Lycée Classique? As you know, Latin was my best course. She laughed because such a claim was so unlike her. And she sensed that he was seeing the way forward, her way. Except on matters of his diet and the disciplines of insulin injection, Rachel had rarely pushed back against her father's will. Yet it was all at once apparent that he had raised her for this moment. She said, the only question, Papa, is, are you right in what you propose about Peter Abelard, or are you wrong? I am right, he answered. And your findings could help our people? They could. They could, if somehow my voice was heard in France. Your voice, Rachel said with the absolute certitude of a worshipful daughter, will be heard. His eyes brimmed when he said, as yours is now. Abelard A. Israel was to have been the book's title, a direct elucidation of the medieval philosopher's radically ecumenical attitude toward Jews, an attitude that had been lost to history. Saul Vedette meant to offer a new interpretation of Peter Abelard's known work, and an argument that heretofore anonymous texts, unusual in their Jew-friendliness, belonged in the Abelard canon. Less a pedant's dry treatise than a robust narrative, the work aimed to lift up Abelard as an alternative model of French esprit for the widest possible readership. Vedette's igniting hope was that with the imprimatur of the Institut Medieval, his book would be published anonymously, of course, and presented at a Sorbonne symposium, all under the noses of the Nazis, to whom arcane Gallic medievalism would be angels dancing on a pinhead. But once it was published, the angels would fly, for Peter Abelard was a beloved progenitor of the nation. Across 1,000 years, Abelard's fame had competed with his infamy, a heretic or a wise philosopher, a hero of modern humanism, but also the bête noire of anti-modern Catholicism, which only endeared him more to the anti-clerics of the French Enlightenment. Always, of course, he was celebrated, or reviled, as the inventor, with Eloise, of modern love. They were the Romeo and Juliet, Tristan and Isolde, Lancelot and Guinevere, of La France. But what concerned Vedette, and centrally the story he told, was the all but ignored question of Abelard's attitude toward Jews. The improbable Jewish scholar had begun, in 1940, by isolating the anonymous texts and transcriptions likely to have come from the sacked libraries of the two Benedictine foundations that had, through all fluctuations, continued to preserve some association with Abelard, the monastery he'd founded for Eloise, the Paraclete, and Cluny itself. Through the same methods of close analysis that had shaped his Talmudic study, Vedette identified rubrics, word choices, and original constructions peculiar to Abelard. Once Vedette was barred from the archive in 1941, and reconciled to his insistent daughter's collaboration, he instructed her in what to look for in the transcriptions, Abelard's invented words, characteristic phrases, and always the word Judaeus. When those or a dozen other particular constructions leapt out at her, she painstakingly copied the entire text to bring home yet another essential clue to the literary detective work that had come to define the life of her father, the housebound Jew. The debt's foray into the deep past, viewed through the lens of Jewish jeopardy, made him more attuned to the true meaning of the present, perhaps, than anyone in Paris. That was what his daughter saw, and what she insisted on advancing. It was as if, even in his isolation, her brilliant father had been lifted, eagle-like, to a great altitude, from which he looked down with rare clarity on the full moral scale of the Nazi occupation and the Vichy surrender. Rachel saw the thing clearly. This deadly turn in the French story did not have to be. It could have gone another way, and the pivot point ages ago was the place of Jews. Saul Vedette was an archaeologist of the national soul, quickening history to change the way people thought in their own astonishing time. Rachel was exhilarated to be helping him. Saul Vedette was bringing the past into the present to save lives. Of course, she urged him on. But then, only weeks ago, had come the Sorbonne verdict. Her father's mistake in handing his preliminary draft over was to trust a man he thought a friend, Jean-Marie Laurent, the eminent Catholic philosopher, expert on Thomas Aquinas, and chair of the Institut Médiéval. Instead of giving Vedette the informal manuscript reading he sought, Laurent convened an official academic committee to review Abelard et Israël, as if Professor Saul Vedette were a junior scholar up for promotion. Laurent sent word that he would be coming to the Vedette apartment, but made no mention of the committee. No sooner had the three professors arrived than Rachel sensed, from their uniformly sour expressions, that she herself had made the more grievous miscalculation, just in encouraging her father in the project, enabling it. The committee had come to make its finding official. Its procedural formality was made ludicrous, of course, by the fact that the Donish verdict could not be presented as ritual required in the ornate seminar hall at the Musée de Cluny, since the petitioning author was a banished Jew. As Rachel arranged chairs for the three Stoic professors in the cramped living room, after they declined her offer of tea, her grasp of their dark mood made her wonder why they hadn't just sent a negative letter. What was Monsieur Laurent up to? Rachel withdrew to her sleeping alcove and sat on her cot to watch. Her view was half obscured by the alcove curtain, which she half used to hide behind. Soon enough, the thing was clear. The three professors, formally dressed in dark suits and ties, sat like the judges of an appellate court, lacking only white linen tabs at their collars. Saul Vedette was in his armchair, dressed in his best suit and tie. If he shared his daughter's foreboding, he did not show it. He had received his former confreres with genuine warmth, and now calmly awaited their response to his work. Laurent took the lead. Elegantly tailored, he wore bushy but well-trimmed gray hair and a full mustache. He made a show of composing himself, adopting a neutral countenance, and stiffening his posture, the small of his back firmly against the chair. The faces of his colleagues were stony. One of them was striking in his bony leanness, and the other for the sheen on his bald pate. A mournful expression crossed Laurent's face as he reached into his valise and pulled out the typescript of Abelard et Israël. Its pages, Rachel saw, were vivid with pasted-on place markers of yellow and red. He put the stack of pages on the low table, which, for Rachel, suddenly took on the character of a judicial bench. "You make a large argument, monsieur," Laurent began. Vedette interrupted him. "Monsieur Jean-Marie, how long has it been since you so addressed me?" Vedette's tone was friendly, but Rachel heard a challenge in her father's maintaining the familiar form, too. Laurent ignored the interruption to continue with what Rachel now heard as a rehearsed statement. But it is deeply flawed and insulting to the deposit of Catholic faith. Faltering momentarily, Laurent withdrew a page from the inside pocket of his suit coat, and following notes, announced what he called the definitive conclusion of the review committee. Rachel leaned forward to hear. With clipped efficiency, speaking as to a self-deceived doctoral candidate, Laurent told one of the great living medievalists, first, that his interpretations of Abelard's known works were unsupported by any objective reading. Especially egregious was the failure to reckon satisfactorily with Peter Abelard's commentary on Romans, in which Laurent said, "The philosopher's orthodoxy on the Jewish question is clear." Vedette cut in, still calmly. "The Jewish question, Jean-Marie, is that phrase Peter Abelard's, or is it St. Paul's?" Laurent blushed. "The question of Israel's replacement." "I say then," Vedette recited, "hath God cast away his people? By no means. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew." "As I show, Abelard features that verse from Romans, chapter 11. Laurent replied, "He wrestles with the verse, that's true." And then he added, "But not features, in no way features." Laurent conveyed a sudden disdain, and Rachel sensed how her father had offended him, a Jew presuming to offer instruction on the epistles of Paul. Laurent continued firmly, "Abelard's commentary is clear on the matter, orthodox. Israel is superseded. The church replaced the synagogue in God's affection. A sad thing for Jews, but the truth, and from that truth, all the Jews' problems follow." Vedette shrugged with apparent equanimity, but Rachel sensed his iron will and his refusal to be baited. He said, "And as I demonstrate, Jean-Marie, the commentary came early in Abelard's work. The philosopher's first conclusions might also have been superseded in his later writing." "Not demonstrated," a second professor interjected, the bald one. "His conclusions were orthodox," the man insisted. Laurent glanced at his colleague sharply, conveying that he, as chair, was the one to speak. But again Saul Vedette intervened, looking directly at the second professor. "You emphasize Abelard's orthodoxy, monsieur, yet surely you know that he was condemned as a heretic at the Council of Sens for being unorthodox." The professor replied, "That was for his muddled teaching on the Trinity." "Not for that alone, monsieur. The anathema was pronounced for his quite unmuddled refusal to say the Jews had sinned." Rachel marveled at her father's poise. "You will find the council's declaration in Denziger. Shall I give you the reference?" Laurent raised his hand. "This is not a disputation. This is a presentation of the committee's conclusions." With another silencing glance at his colleague, Laurent went on quickly with the summary, that the case for the textual parallels and stylistic echoes between settled Abelard writings and anonymous manuscripts was unreliable. Simply ridiculous was the central assumption of Vedette's argument, that Abelard manifested otherwise unheard-of pro-Jewish sentiments because he had intimate exchange with Jewish counterparts, even depending on texts written by a contemporary Spanish Jew. But when Saul Vedette now raised his hand, Rachel was alarmed to see an unprecedented tremor in his fingers. For the first time, she sensed his vulnerability. He was too old for this. He was exposed, vulnerable. Perhaps his sugar level had dropped. The rush of rejection was swamping him,
and there was a new uncertain note in his voice as he said, "The physician and philosopher Judah Halevi, I show clearly..." The third professor, the lean one, blurted, "Impossible! Peter Abelard never met Judah Halevi." "I do not say met. I say read. Abelard's dialogue with the Jew repeats..." "Without evidence," the man said. "With plausibility, monsieur," Saul countered, reclaiming authority. "He knew this." "The two thinkers were exact contemporaries," he said. "Abelard had correspondence with Toledo. It would be surprising if he and Halevi were not aware of each other. Our standard of measure across 900 years cannot be certitude. I assert what is plausible." "Fantasy," said the second professor, the bald one. Laurent, having lost control, was discomfited. The bald professor went on. "A Jew's fantasy, as if Peter Abelard needed a tutorial from a Jew." "Why not?" Saul asked quietly. "I myself offered tutorials for a quarter century as a member of the greatest Catholic faculty in France." "Not in sacred theology," Laurent said, hinting at an unexpected remorse. Rachel saw that she had wholly underestimated the danger of what her father had taken on. The insult of a Jew's trespass had infuriated even his old friend, who now had neither the ability nor the wish to defend Saul Vedette further. "Moses?" Vedette asked. "Not sacred?" "That was before, Saul," Laurent said sadly. "Before, Jean-Marie, before what?" When Laurent did not answer, Vedette said, "My friend, I asked you only for your informal reading of what I wrote. I would have welcomed your opinion. Instead, you spring this procedural embuscade like a trap of the Inquisition." "I had no choice," Laurent explained. "You came to me because of my office. You were hoping for an institute symposium. You wanted the imprimatur. It was never going to happen. A decisive negation was required, and now you have it." Vedette shook his head mournfully. He made one last appeal. "Abelard powerfully lifted up the plight of Jews of his own day. There's the important point. He expressly called Jews undeserving of punishment, either in this world or the next." As he spoke, Vedette's voice began to rise and to take on an unprecedented urgency. "Abelard's witness, however dismissed at that time," he continued, "could speak to the conscience of France in our time, an upraised Catholic voice out of the silence to save Jewish lives. Right now, think of it." "I have thought of it," Laurent said. He had retreated into his formal role. "But this is a matter of scholarship, and we have given you our scholarly conclusions." He stood, and then the other two did as well. With a flick of his hand toward the stacked pages before him, Laurent concluded, "The work is selective, incomplete, shallow." Vedette remained sitting, holding his old friend's eyes. The Jew said quietly, "You are blushing, Jean-Marie. It is fitting. You should be ashamed." Laurent turned to lead the way out, but the bald professor hesitated. From the door he looked back at Saul Vedette and said, with narrowed eyes, "Are you registered?" "I beg your pardon," Vedette replied. "As required, are you registered?" Vedette did not answer. Rachel clutched at the curtain, drew it to her mouth. She recognized the moment for the threat it was, but abstractly. She could not conjure what actual danger loomed. When the men had departed, leaving the typescript where it was, Rachel remained on the edge of her cot, awaiting her father's signal. Instead of turning to her,
He simply slumped in his chair. She realized that he had held himself upright, apparently stalwart by an act of will. She was pierced with anger.